Welcome to Coach Your Brains Out, the show that explores learning from the top minds in volleyball and beyond. With your hosts, John Mayer, Billy Allen, Andrew Fuller, and Nils Nielsen.
We're thrilled to welcome to the show the head of athletic performance and science for the Irish Rugby Football Union, Dr. Nick Winkleman. Thanks for joining us, Nick.
John and Billy, my absolute pleasure. You can just call me Coach. My mom calls me Doctor. I did it for her, but Coach is okay.
Yeah, well, Coach is a good, it's a good moniker, so we'll go with that. Well, congrats on writing such a practical, useful book. I know it's considered a textbook, but man, it's so easy to read and so useful. So congrats, it's a must read. So thank you for writing it. But what drew you to dive so deeply into language?
Yeah, so it's interesting. You know, my mom always told me as a kid that I talked too much. My mouth was either going to get me into trouble or it's going to make me money. So maybe there was something there from birth that I always had an interest in communication. But I would say my first collision with language and its importance in a coaching context came when I was in college and I was learning how to become a personal trainer alongside getting my exercise science degree. And like many individuals who are coming up in any form of coaching, whether it's S&C, sport, or the like, I had a mentor. And so I remember just watching him day in, day out and how effective he was with clients. He was so skilled in just communicating generally. He'd always get them to laugh. They always seemed to be really engaged. And what puzzled me was that his programming, like what he would do in the gym, he would still bench press on Mondays and have people squat on Tuesdays, right? There was nothing different in the X's and O's of what he did, but ultimately he seemed to get better results and have a cultivate a better experience for the client in achieving those results. And one day it dawned on me that what he was doing so differently from all the other trainers I was shadowing and surrounding myself with was the way he was wielding the word, the way he was communicating. He just seemed to take the moment right before they would perform a set or a rep of whatever the exercise was. And it was almost like that moment was sacred. And he would make sure that he would just give them one simple, oftentimes funny, very visual idea to help them move better. And so that's kind of what he became known for. Funny enough, he worked a lot in bodybuilding. And in bodybuilding, there's always this whole idea around getting precise activation of a very nuanced muscle in the low delt or low back. And so he could use language oftentimes to get people to focus in such a way as to get that activation, to get that specific range of motion, as he'd always say. Now, I was 19 or 20 at the time. And so I recognized that what he was doing was pretty important, but I didn't know what to do with it yet because I was still trying to figure out program design and biomechanics and movement. And so I had to still kind of earn the right to develop the craft. But fast forward almost a decade after that, and I was leading the NFL Combine development program at a place called Exos. So I was helping, you know, American footballers, collegiate American football players go into the NFL via the NFL Combine and specifically supporting them, you know, running a fast 40-yard dash, vertical jump, and all that good stuff. I was glorified track coach. And in those moments, I was reminded in literally an instantaneous moment one January how important communication was. I found myself almost being stuck behind my eyes, focusing on coaching the program rather than coaching the person. And so it was in that moment, it was actually in 2009 this happened, I was reminded back to that earlier experience. And it was at that catalyst point that I said, okay, I have to study and develop how I coach with the same level of rigor as what I coach. And ultimately, when we look at how we coach, how we translate what's in our head to what inevitably we want to show up in our athlete's body, one of the primary necessary ways to do that, language and the intersection it has with athletic focus and movement.
That's awesome. Well, to start this talk, can you tell us a little bit about the two common forms of feedback, knowledge of result or KR, and knowledge of performance, KP?
Yeah, certainly, Billy. So, you know, this whole domain of feedback, just generally speaking, is interested in how the presentation of information can help a person learn a skill. Because if we think about learning, what is learning? It's acquiring information. Whether you're learning math, you're learning English, or you're learning to move, we're still codifying information, and it's expressed in what we call skill. It just so happens that the three of us and those listening are interested in information that helps with the skill in a physical form that we call movement. And so classically, KR and KP, these ideas, well, they've been around as long as we've been teaching people, but they really came into the fore in the 70s and the 80s when we became very interested in feedback. And so knowledge of results, KR, is very simply what it says on the tin. It's the outcome that was achieved. And so you guys work in volleyball. I don't, but I know enough maybe to draw on some examples. And so if you're working on serving, KR might be you have specific grids on the opposite side of the court mm-hmm. that you're interested from an accuracy perspective in having the volleyball land. Mm-hmm. And so in those cases, you might, you know, say, hey, you were in the center square or the middle square or the outer square based on almost like a bullseye. And so what you're doing there is simply telling them whether or not they achieved the outcome, the result, and or you gave them some indication of how far they were away from it. And now this is a really, really strong and valuable form of feedback, especially in those that we typically say are at a more experienced level, because they have, let's say, the skill resources to recognize, ah, that wasn't quite as accurate as I wanted. And so now that I have that feedback, I can change my strategy. Ah, next one was in the center square, happy days, right? So that's knowledge of results. Similarly, let's use an example from a different sport. I do a lot of movement skill development generally. So knowledge of results would be how high someone jumped, how fast someone covered 10 meters. And so if you think about it, if you've never served a volleyball before, telling someone, you know, whether or not they got into the accurate square probably would take them ever so far. But if you, as the volleyball coach, were watching them and saying, yeah, their movement strategy here is never going to allow them to have a consistently accurate shot, you'd recognize that the information contained in KR, in knowledge of results, isn't enough. It's not a complete enough picture. And that then is why we have what we call KP. Now, knowledge of performance, let's be honest, guys, when we hear the word performance, it means a lot of different things to different people. But here, performance is emphasizing the word perform. And so it's providing feedback on how the person physically performed the movement that led to the outcome. And so knowledge of performance on a volleyball serve might be talking about the way the person contacted the ball, maybe the height of the contact, the specific position of the arm or the body. And so you're actually providing technical information around the skill process that would precede and ideally lead to the result. And so knowledge of performance tends to be directed in the literature and in just practical circles to the novice, the person still learning the skill. But let's be really practical here. Both of you are volleyball coaches, and the people listening are likely volleyball coaches or volleyball players themselves. Even as an elite volleyball player, there are still times where you're looking under the hood. You're trying to get better. You're trying to, at the very least, stabilize this good technique. And so it's never going to be a one or the other. Both of them are in play. But we could argue that traditionally you start with more KP. As they earn the right and understand just implicitly how to move better, you start introducing more KR. I'd argue you can use both of them simultaneously fairly early on. And as I move, let's say, into a competitive phase, I'd probably want to start backing off the knowledge of performance and focusing more on the knowledge of results. Why? Well, just pragmatically, do you want your volleyball player thinking about head, shoulders, knees, and toes when they're trying to score the winning shot? Probably not. And so when we give someone knowledge of results, we are leaving it up to them to implicitly solve the movement problem. And basically what that protects against typically is that paralysis by analysis, When we provide too much feedback around knowledge or performance, too much technical insight, sometimes it creates what I call cognitive pollution. Just put simply too many ideas in the mind for what the person can handle in a learning or in a competitive context. So let me be honest, there are books written on these two things. So that was very much so your bumper sticker tour, but I think that at least sets us up to build on it.
Well, it was a good bumper sticker tour because I've read some of the books and I still get confused around it. So thank you for
you and me both, John.
But I like the framework. So the experts is more the knowledge of results, and the beginners more often knowledge of performance. Sometimes I feel like I work with a college level, so you know, maybe closer to that expert level. But it feels like it's, you know, an obvious thing when you give knowledge of results. And as a coach, you know, your ego gets in and you want to feel like you're giving them all this, you know, helpful stuff, this technical stuff. So I guess, how do you get over like the ego side of it, you know, and still like come off as this, you know, coach who knows what they're talking about?
I think step one is what you just demonstrated there, John, and recognizing is your coaching motivated by the desire to be recognized for making a difference on the athlete, or is your desire for the athlete to learn? And so, you know, John Wooden put it best, you have not taught, we could say you have not coached until the athlete has learned. Mm-hmm. And so ultimately I cannot force you to learn, John. I am not literally in your head tweaking around neurons and connecting the pathways to get you to move better. Coaching at its best is an indirect process. I offer you a space to learn. We call that the physical environment. And I guide you like a Sherpa up a mountain. I guide you in how to navigate that environment. But ultimately, you're the one that has to put one foot in front of the other. Mm-hmm. So oftentimes what we do is we steal, literally, that is the right word. We steal learning opportunities by injecting ourselves. Mm-hmm. I'd argue at times interfering too quickly. And so, you know, I remember when I was never great at math, and my dad was like I don't know who the equivalent would be in volleyball, but like baseball at the time, he's like the Ken Griffey Jr. of math. And so I would be doing a math problem and he would just give me the answer. But the reality is, even though he gave me the answer, he gave me the solution, just do this, it didn't help me get to the answer. I didn't develop the machinery to solve it myself. At the end of the day, our players need to solve the problem themselves. And so the ability to identify when an athlete is still in problem-solving mode versus they've exhausted their problem-solving capability. I really think that is the space, the space where good becomes great when it comes to coaches. And so again, from a volleyball perspective, if I'm watching someone serve and, you know, it's in, then it's out, it's in, then it's out, it's inconsistent. But if I'm seeing that there are glimpses, there are flashes of that ideal technique for that person, and that's starting to associate with the result, I'm going to be very encouraging, right? And I'm going to be encouraging them to continue to problem solve, to continue to try to find the answer for themselves. And I might nudge, and we can talk about this later, with some, let's say, light cueing, just to help them shape their mental spotlight of what they're focusing on, to maybe give them some mental direction. But I'm not going to go in and say, hey, your elbow needs to be here, your wrist needs to be here, and if you just do this, it'll be perfect. Because then I steal the problem solving and I might overload their brain, distracting them from the implicit problem solving they were going through in the first place. However, we also have the experience where you're watching someone perform a skill in any sport and their technique has stabilized. Almost like if you drop a golf ball down a rolling slope, it inevitably will come to a basin. It will stop, it'll stabilize. And so if I'm watching someone move, and it doesn't matter, rain, shine, high or low, this is the way they move. Their technique is, I'm going to use the word stuck in its current form. And they're not problem solving anymore. They're not searching for solutions. My knowledge of results is not breaking through to them. It is now a responsibility that I help them access a source of information to break through that change. Does that make sense? And so it's kind of understanding that space of, are they still exploring or have they exhausted that exploration? And we surf that continuum. When they're exploring mode, I'm stepping back, creating the space for that exploration. But when they've exhausted their ability to explore and figure out a solution, then I'm leaving them to drown. They're now suffering because they cannot find a solution. They no longer have the tools. It is my do no harm. It is my responsibility to step in and help guide them to a source of information to make, to break through and make the change and explore once again.
That's great. Such good stuff there. I mean, I think the big shift I think I've started to make is, and I've learned going through this ecological approach is, you know, my job is not to be the provider of solutions, but trying to identify problems and give them opportunities to solve the problems. But I think that of, you know, observing your learner, giving them opportunities, noticing when they get stuck, that's when you can step in. I think that's really helpful. That's when you can use that KP. I'm starting to get my head around this. Thank you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I like that. Let's just put it into an alliteration. If they get stuck, step in, you know, or if they get stuck long enough, step in.
Yeah. I like the
something
long enough.
Like that, just to remind ourselves, because I think you're dead right. The other thing is this, just a final piece on the feedback front. You know, we have this idea of task intrinsic feedback, the TIF, task intrinsic feedback. And so volleyball, I usually can see where the ball landed. I know whether or not it landed in the right spot. I know whether or not I hit it. And so there's a lot of task intrinsic KR built into your sport. In a sport like sprinting, where I do a lot of it, there's not a lot of task intrinsic feedback. The person doesn't know how fast they went and they can't actually correlate that to their movement. That's not readily available to them. And so I think the key piece with any coaching, any skill, is you're trying to minimize unnecessary task intrinsic feedback. It's like telling a basketball player you missed the shot. It's like, well, duh, that adds no new information. It's like being in a room with the light on and you telling the person, hey, the light's on. It adds no new information. So another way to remove your ego, to remove yourself, is ask yourself, am I providing a source of information that maybe it's readily available, but they're not acquiring it? Or, right, it's not readily available, so I have to offer it. Or am I just providing feedback because it's about ego and I feel like I have to talk, right? And so that's typically where coaches get into this loop, which creates a negative cycle where I'm just telling you things you already know. And think about that from a personal perspective. When someone just tells you all these things you need to change that are self-evident, there are few things as frustrating as that in any human relationship. So just think about that as another guide to know whether or not what you're saying is valuable. Is it informing or interrupting?
I was going to move on from this KPKR a couple times, but I'm too into it, so I got to ask one more. How often with your athletes are you maybe giving knowledge of result when it's a, you know, we would say maybe not a positive, but a productive rep versus a mistake?
Yeah. So, okay. This is really interesting. There's a number of really nice studies out there. And there's probably been more since I've updated myself on it, whereby they give the athlete or they give the subject the opportunity to ask for feedback whenever they'd like. And so one of the studies, now this has been replicated, was in children using their non-dominant, so their offhand, for an accuracy task. So they were like, I don't know, 5-10 meters away from a target. And it was kind of like your beachside toss a beanbag in a hole type game. But what was interesting is they had a partition. So to start the study, I'm throwing it with my left hand, but I'm right hand dominant, so it's kind of awkward. I see the target in front of me, but then they put this partition up, so I cannot see it at all. And I'm tossing the beanbag, obviously with the goal for these kids to be as accurate as possible. Now, what's interesting is they allow the kids to pick when they get feedback. So they get feedback anytime they want. And so, John, if you're in the study, you're like, yeah, I want some feedback, we drop the partition and you can see where the beanbag landed. So it's interesting. And so I'm going through however many hundreds of reps they do on this thing, and I'm choosing feedback. Now, here's what's really interesting. John, you got to choose feedback but Billy didn't. So Billy's in the group on day two, but whenever you chose feedback, let's say it was on rep 3, rep 7, rep 14, so on and so forth, that's when Billy gets feedback, even though he doesn't self-select it. So we have you select when you want the feedback. Mm-hmm. Billy is just given feedback whenever we feel we want to give it to him based on how you've performed. And so you and Billy are completely matched. The only difference is John chose when he got feedback and Billy didn't. So a couple different things emerge from this research construct. Firstly, people only ask for feedback around 30% of the time. Now, I think that shocks a lot of people. You would think that they would want feedback every single time. But in fact, it tends to be less than 50%, in some studies down to 15%. Now, let me just put a footnote under that. There was something back in the late 70s, 80s called the guidance hypothesis, which has been debunked a little bit. But the guidance hypothesis, just pragmatically speaking, was based on this theory that if I gave you feedback too often, you would become dependent on me as the feedback source, on me as the information source, and thus you wouldn't learn how to get feedback from the environment. You wouldn't learn how to get implicit feedback from your own body, and thus you'd have this dependence on the coach. And so back then, based on some studies, they stipulated that feedback should be given, you know, one out of every two. So 33 to 50% of the time, right? With this idea that over time you want to fade your feedback, allowing more of the reps to be under the control of the athlete completely. Now, fast forward, interestingly enough, we have this new research construct I just went through, and it almost confirms a little bit of the classic research that when given the opportunity, even when learning something for the first time, people are only asking for feedback around 30%. Now, here's the real interesting thing. You asked John about the nature of the outcome, right? Should I give feedback when it's positive, when it's negative? And so this is what's really cool. What they found out was that statistically, people asked for feedback. So John, in this case, you would ask for feedback more often when it was a positive result. Mm. That means on that rep, you had this intuitive sense like, ooh, I think that was the one. Drop the partition, boom, got it. So it's almost like, hey, when you knew it was bad, you didn't need anybody else to tell you it was bad.
Right.
But when it was good, right, that's new information, because that means you did something in that moment that was a little bit better and closer to this thing you're pursuing. And that's when you self-selected the feedback. And so the final thing I'll tell you is this about that study. Even though the accuracy during the actual practice would have been no different between you and Billy, when we bring you back a few days later and do a retention test, John, you would have retained more of that skill, meaning you would retain your accuracy better than Billy. And so now we know, I know you've talked about Gabrielle Wolf's work in the optimal learning theory. One of the key mediating factors, and I think any coach who's worth their salt says, duh, that the more invested your athlete is in what they're doing and the learning process, the more they pay attention to what they're doing. And attention is the currency of learning, which is why it makes sense. So what do we know? Involving the athlete in the learning process, really helpful for learning. Hey, we probably don't need to provide feedback as often as we think we do. You know, even in that 50% or less is probably going to work even for a novice. And that, hey, it seems that if, when given the opportunity, implicitly, intuitively, we want feedback on when it's good, because that's new information. We're well aware of the many versions of bad, but it's that subtle version of good that we're really chasing at the end of the day. And so I think hopefully that construct puts some richness in what coaches can think about in consideration to your question.
Yeah, and that falls into the optimal theory with enhanced expectations. I feel like that fits in well, because you're giving feedback on those reps where they have a positive image of what happened. You're enhancing their expectations. So,
absolutely. And now, inevitably, you're gonna have a listener who's saying, "Are you telling me when it's negative, I can't say anything?" No. That is certainly there will be no absolutes. You know, well, almost no absolutes in a lot of what I say. And certainly that's not an absolute here. However, it's in the phrasing of it. And so if there is a negative result that I want to comment on, whether it's, KR is just, it is what it is. But if there's a negative result where I want to provide some knowledge of performance, it's simply you thinking that, and this is how we can get into maybe some language, rather than saying, John or Billy, you did not do or stop doing, just flip that language around and say, okay, John, on the next repetition, I want you to focus on. Billy, on the next repetition, I want you to focus on. And so all of a sudden now, it becomes additive. It becomes positive. It becomes solution and action oriented. And so when I tell you to not do something, I've actually provided you with minimal new information. I've just simply said, stop doing that. But there's many other versions of what you want the person to stop doing. And so rather than telling them what not to do, be very clear and precise in your language, be forward in your language, focus on, try to achieve, let's attack this, action that, so on and so forth.
You will hear more from Dr. Nick Winkelman next week as we continue our discussion on language and cueing. Be sure to check out Dr. Winkelman's book, The Language of Coaching. You can learn more about it at thelanguageofcoaching.com.